I'm Uncle Skeeter, inviting you back next week as we help to spread the cheese.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Underrepresented music, local voices, and real people. You keep CJSF independent.
Welcome to Scream Therapy. I'm your host, Jason Schurz. In October of 2018, I found myself in the hospital, sitting across from a psychiatrist who was telling me I had bipolar. I was sent home with a bunch of medication and laid on the couch for a week. I had my iTunes library on shuffle, trying to shake the hornet's nest from my head. Ever since I was a kid, I've been using loud music as a form of therapy. Punk rock and mental health have always been connected. This podcast looks at that connection through the lens of different guests. This is Scream Therapy. You're listening to episode 120.5 of the Scream Therapy podcast, a recap of the past 10 episodes, with people who linked their involvement in the punk rock scene with their mental health and the mental health of others. With each of these conversations, I learn more and more about how to maintain stability while living with mental health conditions that I have to manage every day. Like the peer-led support groups I'm part of, talking to other punks about their experiences has been instrumental in my health. My hope is that you, the listener, will find inspiration and feel supported by the stories in these episodes. On episode 111, Lance Curran of Chicago post-hardcore band With Patience joined me to talk about the survivor's guilt he felt after a friend committed suicide. Growing up a depressed teen, Lance always wondered how he was able to get through those years when others hadn't. He explained that getting into punk rock and playing in bands was the outlet he needed to process his grief.
Well, it was really hard because, like, this was a really good friend, and I had no idea that he was in a bad place where, like, I was really a depressed kid. I had suicidal thoughts a lot. I had, you know, a lot of things going through my head, and this guy was kind of like he helped bring me out of my shell when I was, like, in middle school, you know. He helped becoming his friend was, like, kind of helped me get a little bit out of some bad spots I was in, and we did a lot of fun stuff together. And then it was a complete surprise when he took his own life, and you're kind of like, how was that not me? And also, like, why did I not see something was wrong? I mean, again, I'm in middle school at the time. It's, you know, you're not really thinking anyone's going to do something like this.
Chad Price came onto the podcast for episode 112. Chad talked about his life as a recovering alcoholic, known for his work in All, Drag the River, A Vulture Wake, and now the Chad Price Peace Coalition. He spent decades trying to balance his heavy drinking with constant travel, parties, parties, and more parties. Chad talked about how being in a punk band can be conducive to substance misuse.
And it was all about partying. We would go on tour. Everybody shows up to basically party with the band. They know what's going to happen when they get there. Everybody's going to rage. It's going to be a party. And it was just out of control. Ugly. All of us. Some people could function a little better, but I didn't care. I was just out there just to, you know, I was like so deep in alcoholism at that point that I didn't care. It was like, it was no longer even about the music.
I welcomed Ali Jados of Chicago post-punk band Violets onto the show for episode 113. Ali talked about awareness around one's mental health and how it helps with stability. We discussed the importance of mental health diagnoses versus focusing on what makes us inspired and creative.
I don't really like labels. Like, I think they can be helpful in certain cases, but I also think that you keep associating yourself. For me, like, I don't try to focus on, oh, I have ADHD or OCD or whatever. I know that I have those tendencies, and I know that, but I don't try to, like, associate with them because I just don't want to feed them. I try to be aware of it and then, like, kind of, like, try to divert. But also, like, that's just part of who I am too. So I just try to embrace those things and like try to navigate my focus on things that I love that can be more beneficial, I guess. Over time, I guess you get better at it.
On episode 114, Micah Sopley of Unseemlier and other bands discussed how living in a capitalist society feeds anxiety and fear. As a punk, Mike tried to avoid real life for as long as he could. This has left him in a challenging place between having freedom and falling in line with society for financial stability.
A lot of my anxiety, I feel like, also stems from that side of the culture where it's be a man, get a job. If you're late, you lose your job. I call it alarm anxiety. I remember my dad telling me when he was really little that he didn't sleep through the night. I don't sleep through the night if I have an alarm set. If I know that I have to be up at a certain time, sometimes it'll be 15 minutes before the alarm, but sometimes if my alarm's set for 6 a.m., I'll wake up at 2 a.m., tumble around for 4 hours. And it's all under that capitalist guise of, you need to be here on time or else you're going to get fired. And if you lose your job, then you're going to lose your house. And, you know, it's all like the doom and gloom side of like what you're taught when you're younger. I say all this with a grain of salt because my father also like was very into the idea. He was like, oh, go tour while you're young. If you don't want to have kids early, you don't have a career yet, like do all of this while you're young because you'll have the rest of your life to do the other stuff. And now I'm at the rest of my life part and I just want to go back.
Clinical social worker Carrie Eberhardy guested on episode 115. Carrie talked about her work in sand play therapy, a safe and protected space where people can explore different parts of themselves. Carrie rediscovered punk rock later in life and recalled how she used bands like The Descendants to reclaim her youth.
We forget how to play as adults, and if we were to allow ourselves to be more heart-centered and kind of play-friendly, the world would be a better place, in my opinion. Just that playful quality. So many times people say, oh, you just, you know, you work with kids. They come into my office and there's shelves of all of these figures and different things. And I'm like, actually, I only work with adults now. I have worked with kids, but that was many years ago. With sand play therapy, it is of any age to do this work. And there are a lot of different components to it. It's not for everybody, but the people who are drawn to it, and usually I would say a lot of more punk rock people that I have worked with are like, oh, tell me about that. Like, what is that? I'm going to do it.
Episode 116 featured Mike Hard from Noise Rocker's God Bullies. Mike talked about how capitalism makes us all, quote unquote, mentally ill. He also discussed the effect that today's world has on our psyche and how it's impossible not to experience mental anguish in this day and age.
The society we live in, a capitalist society where we're taught to consume instead of to care. And as it gets even more like in this time we're living now, you're going to just see more mental illness because the two things don't go together. It's like a mixed signal. And that mixed signal, your mind kind of is easy for your mind to mess up. William Burroughs says it perfectly, is that we live in a junky society, that capitalism is nothing more than junky dump. That when you got lots of money and you got lots of dope, you're at the top of the thing. You feel you're invincible and you're happy as hell. But when you start either can't get any money or the money gets cut off, then now you got anxiety. Now you got sickness. Now you start thinking, do I need to steal to get the money for it? Is that mental illness or is that just responding to stimulant in your environment?
Sean Kathman was my guest on episode 117. Sean is the founder of Start Today Harm Reduction, which spreads the word about safe substance use in the punk scene. A personal tragedy shaped Sean's path towards helping others. He is now a nurse at a substance use disorder clinic.
My main thing that I talk about a lot is my buddy who passed away from a heroin overdose in 2013. At that time, I was in nursing school, kind of just floating around. I had ideas that I want to do psych and substance and that kind of stuff. Once that happened with him, that fully did it for me. I wanted to help people not feel the way that I did and my friends and family and all that kind of stuff. So on the outside, that's how I've dealt with actual hard drugs and things like that. Personally, I'm an alcoholic. I stopped drinking almost 2 years ago with my wife, who also is part of Start Today. navigating everything. It's very odd when you start drinking at like 12, 13, because you think that's what you're supposed to be doing, and then stopping pretty abruptly, like mid-30s. That's a long time. You kind of have to like figure everything back out. Like, it's very odd.
Saren Blowett of Vancouver, BC punk band Alien Boys came on to episode 118 to talk about the culture of care. Having worked in harm reduction services for more than 15 years, Saren linked their involvement in the punk scene and its empathic ethos to the important work they do in healthcare.
I feel very lucky that I've got to maintain this as an outlet for all that I do. So it's like I kind of feel as though I eat, breathe, and live those like tenets of harm reduction and uplifting priority populations as much as I can. It's funny because when Alien Boys started, most of us in the band at the time were also working in harm reduction service provision. So that's been a very important part of who we are. This is kind of part of this other aspect where whenever we go on tour, it doesn't matter where we are. The most beautiful thing to me is when folks come up and feel safe enough to have a conversation with me about some of the lyrics in some of our songs and just say that they felt that there was that relatability and that it gave them a sense of hope or it gave them a sense of being seen. I think that's what we all want, especially if we're in our lower spaces. And so just being able to reach out and touch people in that way, make them feel like they can be empowered and that they are there. Everyone just wants to be heard.
On episode 119, I welcomed Max Lajoie, singer-guitarist of Spite House and a music producer in Montreal. Max shared how he has processed his grief after losing both of his parents within a 10-year span of each other.
With my dad, it's almost like I could see it coming and felt powerless about it. And in the same way I did with my mom, but it was like, I don't know how to say, it was like so out of my hands. With my dad, I felt like I had a responsibility and like that I could save him somehow. And with my mom, it was like there was nothing to do about it. It created like with my dad, like this kind of like blur of what am I doing? Who am I? I'm just gonna hold on to music. And with my mom, it was like, okay, so like life is really short and you can get a call and 10 days later you're dead. So it was like more of a wake-up call for my own life. Stop just drifting in life. Stop living in fear of what other people will think.
Finally, on episode 120, Harry Bailey from UK queercore duo Death Goals discussed how punk rock has been the best and worst thing in their lives. Harry explained that the anxiety, existential dread, and gender dysphoria they feel has been outweighed by the joy of playing music and being part of the punk scene.
The ability to use it as a tool of expression and work through feelings of like grief when my grandparents died or just general social angst and worry has been like invaluable. Now, Death Goals has also been the source of many of my worst meltdowns and insecurities getting the worst of me. I have a terrible case of imposter syndrome, constantly comparing myself to friends, especially on the release of our second album, which took me to a really dark place where now my relationship with that whole album, which is an album people really like, is quite skewed because I just spent so much of it panicked and worrying and diving into the worst parts of the internet, seeking out terrible reviews and people's worst opinions on us and really like sitting on that. So that's not a great thing, but I think Death Goals brings a lot of joy to people. It's brought a lot of joy to me, and that's our main focus. We want to be this beacon for joy in a world which is not very joyful.
I encourage you to go back and listen to these full episodes and many more at screentherapyhq.com. I recently appeared on the Recovery Diaries in Depth podcast to talk about essays that I'd written for their publication a few years back. The idea was to look back on those essays and reflect on where I am today. Here's a clip of my conversation with host Gabriel Nathan.
Jason Schurz, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Recovery Diaries in Depth.
You're most welcome, Gabe. Thanks for having me.
Writing about your mental health that can be scary, opening up about something so vulnerable. And, you know, that's what we ask people to do all the time on Recovery Diaries. We're asking you to sit down and share a very vulnerable piece of you. Do you think while you were in that place of sort of, as you put it, sitting and wallowing in those feelings, were you looking for outlets? Were you looking for ways to get it out?
At that point, it was really all I could do. I mean, I still was doing some music stuff. It was really rough, like coming out of a diagnosis like that. It was like really like on the couch, can't get up, just, you know, splitting headaches. You know, I had a psychotic episode, so that's compared to a head injury. You know, I was like really getting bludgeoned by cinder block, you know, and so other outlets really fell to the side. And I had a really hard time writing too. I just basically gave up on it. I thought, I'm not going to bother doing this anymore. It's just not fulfilling me. One of the things about depression is you start to not enjoy anything that you used to enjoy. And writing was a huge enjoyment for me. So yeah, it was really just about, like I said, almost a survival technique. Like I knew how to write. I'd done it my whole life. So like I'll get to the keyboard and whatever comes out, and at least I'm getting something out. And the rest of those activities that I was really into kind of just fell away.
Have things come back for you since then?
Yes, hugely.
What was that process like, finding those things again?
Slow, difficult, painful. I slowly brought in things that I was interested in doing, but there was a new lens to it because, of course, a lot of that was mental health, whereas I never really spoke about that before. You know, there were kind of like flashes of things that I saw in my writing in retrospect. But I never really tackled mental health as being a thing in my life. And so, you know, all of a sudden I was really taking that on, learning a lot about bipolar, which I was diagnosed with in 2018, learning a lot about things like support groups and different modalities of therapy and like CBT and all those kinds of things, and really just immersing myself in it. So that's kind of how I got to like a sort of a stable place. And then after that, I, you know, got back into the bands and I got back into the writing and I got back into the podcasting and all those things, as well as, you know, things like playing tennis or like just the sort of, the, you know, going for hikes. Those all came back slowly. And now I'm at a place where the mental health stuff is still there and I'm very involved with advocacy and things like that. But it's not like a constant, like, I'm depressed. I want to die. It was, you know, it's like more, I know that it's an issue I'm dealing with, but I'm managing it rather than just like fighting it. You know, there's a certain amount of like giving in and realizing, you know, this has to be dealt with.
Right. It's living with the thing. I feel like a lot of people think that recovery is, oh, I'm recovered. And, you know, now I don't have to deal with this anymore. But it really is a certain amount of acceptance of like, okay, this thing is here. I am living with this mental health challenge. It is a part of me. And so I live with anxiety and depression, and so much of my life has been, I feel, wasted in a way, spent fighting those two issues and pushing up against them and railing against them and having them control me and me resisting that. But as I get older and have learned, okay, this isn't going away, no matter how hard I kick and scream, right? It's more about just accepting that they're here and learning to live the best life that you can with that. I don't know if that's been similar for you in some way.
Oh, exactly. I mean, that's basically what I would have said. One of the things that I really learned to put around language when it comes to mental health issues, and I learned this through other people that I talked to on the podcast, was that turning it around and saying, like, what am I recovering from? Like, where am I trying to get? Am I trying to get back to the way I was before being diagnosed? Because that was horrible. And that was also really scary and awful. And, you know, or am I trying to find something new? And so, you know, more of a transformation language than a recovery language, because really this is a chance for you to change and to be potentially a, well, obviously a different person, but pushing through instead of pushing against it. And I think now I'm a totally different person than I was before. I mean, I'm still me. Like, I'm still got all those same traits and stuff, but it's way more controlled. It's way more measured. And I think the things that I'm doing now make a lot more sense. Yeah, I pulled off some like wild stuff when I was undiagnosed. Like, I mean, I was doing cool things, but now I'm still doing cool things, but I'm doing them in a way that makes a bit more sense or is more realistic to my life.
So that's something that I want to touch on that I think is really important to talk about. you're a very creative person. You know, you're into music and writing and, you know, all of these different creative endeavors. And I think there's this seductive thing about bipolar disorder with mania where creative people are like, oh, wow, well, you know, when I'm hypomanic, like, it's really good. And, you know, I'm creating all the time and I'm staying up till 3 a.m. and I'm doing all this amazing stuff. And then, you know, hypomania slides very scarily into full-blown mania. But people do talk about how it feels good. And especially creative people have heard this. What is helping you? I'm assuming you're on medication, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So what is helping you maintain and being able to say, yes, I did pull off some wild stuff when I was unmedicated and untreated, but this is better. And I'm not tempted to play with fire, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, that also is something that I've thought a lot about and talked to about people in the podcast that come on. But what I've realized is that, yes, when you're unmedicated, undiagnosed, and don't know what's going on, and you're suffering through huge bouts of depression, huge bouts of, like, mania. Okay, so most people with bipolar have kind of a half and half-ish thing. I mean, some people have months or even years of depression and then maybe, like, a week of mania. But a lot of the people that have bipolar that I know, and I know for myself, we're dealing with a kind of a half and half. That's kind of the whole idea, is, you know, you're going like depression, mania. And so when you're depressed, you don't want to do anything. So you're not creating anything when you're depressed. You might be wallowing. You might be writing some thoughts down. You might be like struggling with stuff. And, you know, a lot of good art comes out of struggle as well. But you're really not creating or outputting anything. And when you're manic, you're doing all kinds of stuff. You're staying up all night and you're writing an album worth of songs in 3 hours or whatever you're doing. You know, you're running all over the place at parties. So you're getting a lot accomplished when you're manic, but it may not always be stuff that you can hold on to or use in the end, right? It might just be like pipe dream type stuff. Like a lot of the stuff that I was doing was just like, blah, you know, it was like, there wasn't a lot that I could hold on to in the end. And so I think, you know, there's misconception about, okay, well, I'm going to be super creative if I'm off my medication. I'm going to be super creative and do all these things. And you're only working on half time, first of all. And the stuff you are doing when you're manic can be quite unpredictable and not cool, but maybe way too cool. And a lot of people that I deal with, like I do a support group that I facilitate for bipolar folks. And a lot of these people talk about, yes, like I'm feeling quite flat. You know, I may not be depressed. I may not be manic. I may be like what we call stable, but I'm just like flatlining it, right? So, you know, let's see what I can do if I, you know, maybe I'll go off my meds because it feels so great to be manic. Or maybe I'll start to feel good on hypomania and start to feel kind of like really in the groove. Well, let's just see how far I can go with this before things go sour. And things do go sour for a lot of people. You know, you end up in the hospital or sometimes worse.
Or worse.
So, yeah. So I think, yeah, it's all about, I wouldn't say boring, but I would say like, more measured. One of the guys in my group always says, hey, a boring day is a great day, you know, for a person with bipolar. But
yeah, no handcuffs, no restraints, no forced medication, boring. Give me boring. That's yeah. Great.
But boring with, let's call it boring. I call it, you know, stable. With that comes a lot of really great stuff. Like I'm in a band now where I've written songs that I never would have written when I was manic. Everything was just all about performance art stuff, like smashing things and screaming and improvisational weirdness. And now I write songs that I'm actually like, hey, this is a good song. It's really fun to be in a place where things feel realistic, I guess.
How did you get into music?
When I was a kid, I got into music through skateboarding, getting to skateboarding and really enjoying the thrill of that. And then kind of finding music that was in alignment with that. So a lot of punk rock and metal. But I was quite young. My parents had music and, you know, they played it around the house. And then I remember I had a birthday party where I only invited one person to the birthday party. My rule was like, you have to buy me an album. And he bought me a Tina Turner album. And I was like super stoked.
Wow.
And I've just always loved music. It quite quickly got into the heavy and the fast and the screamy. And that was kind of where what I needed. I needed to have that outlet. I needed to hear back what I was hearing in my head, which was a lot of anguish when I was younger too. And I never really looked back. I've been doing this music stuff for a long, long time, decades and decades now. So it's meant to be.
Yeah. And I know that they're intertwined, but my next question is about writing.
Yeah. Yeah. Same thing. Remember when I was reading magazines when I was a kid, I always thought, at that point, it's like, I want to write about music. I don't want to be in bands. I want to describe and be creative. And that quickly got into volunteering for a bunch of magazines that were writing about music. And I just kind of went with it. And, you know, I was just doing a lot of that stuff. You know, I always kind of wanted to be a writer when I was a kid. I remember writing things for English class and stuff and thinking that's what I want to do. But I think until I found the music angle, it didn't really make a lot of sense. Like, I wasn't thinking I'm going to write a novel when I'm older. I was thinking, like, I want to write about stuff that I care about.
Mm. Since you were published here, I mean, it's been a while. I know you have two essays on the site, but it's been some time. What has changed for you?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, looking at this essay that I wrote, it's hard to read it because it's like things have changed so much. I remember it and I know that it rings true for me in that space. But yeah, it's like, okay, was it me that wrote that? Like, you know, yes, I know that it was, and it is about me, and there's some stuff in it about like my life, and I know the things that I've done, but it's just like my outlook is so different. You know, like, I don't feel like my depressions get nearly as bad as they used to. And so I'm trying to identify with a person 4 years ago, whatever it was, that was just in so much pain and so much existential crisis. And now I feel like I belong in my life. I know what I've, you know, I know what I'm doing and I know why I'm here. And so, yeah, it was tough to look back on that. Things have changed huge.
For more episodes of Screen Therapy, go to screentherapyhq.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. Big news, the Screen Therapy book is available now. Screen Therapy, A Punk Journey Through Mental Health, tells my story and the stories of others who use punk as a catalyst for mental health. Like this podcast, it links the community-minded punk scene with the mental wellness of the punks who belong to it. To order the book, go to screentherapyhq.com. For merch, check out screentherapy.threadless.com. Okay, enough promoting, it's time for some thanking. Thank you for listening to Screen Therapy. Doing this podcast and talking to folks about punk rock and mental health has been a crucial part of my own mental stability, and it means so much to me that you're out there listening. Screen Therapy is created in the Cathet region of coastal British Columbia, Canada, on the traditional territory of the Klahaman Nation. Contact me at screentherapyhq.com or email me at screentherapypodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Let's talk about punk rock and mental health. Until next time, take care and be well.
Yo, it's Eboshi.
Hey, this is Eboshi from Cartel Madras, and you're listening to CJSF.
I was on the back of your mind. I was on the back of your lap. You were in the back of the car. You were in the back of my heart. I was in the back of the bar. You know what I do? Take things too far. Don't know where to start or begin. Don't know how it ends. Don't know how to say what I meant. Don't know how to say how I feel. Baby, is it real? I was like 34 double Ds. You know what I like? Ice cold.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Bernie B.
Is Bird Note. To stay fit for the skies, most birds molt and regrow their flight feathers, one at a time along each wing. For an American robin with a 17-inch wingspan, that's 19 feathers per wing, molted and regrown over 2 months, just after the nesting season each year. Now let's scale up to the wing molt of a snowy albatross, one of the largest flying birds in the world with a whopping 10 to 12 foot wingspan. The snowy albatross, formerly known as the wandering albatross, is an incredibly efficient flyer thanks to those long, narrow wings. Sure, albatrosses may look awkward taking off, but once airborne, they can soar for hours, even days, as they forage for squid and fish on the ocean surface. A tendon locks in place in each wing, allowing them to ride the air currents with little effort or flapping. These birds are supreme gliders. With that gargantuan wingspan, it takes the large albatrosses a full year to molt, and they have to put off breeding until the next year. It's one or the other. Their long wings require a lot of upkeep, but they make the snowy albatross a true master of the wind. This episode is also available in Espanol. To learn more, start at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.